And that was my first 100 finish on a high fat, low carb approach. And I really, the recovery was like crazy because I was in my mid 40s and I was already thinking about retiring and I was just getting beat up. And I thought all the swelling and the soreness after hundreds was because you ran 100 miles. But come to find out, it was mainly the high carb approach.
Running 100 miles seems impossible, and maybe even kind of crazy. And it is, but we believe in big crazy dreams. That's why we ran 100 miles. It was such a life-changing experience for us, we decided to devote this podcast to preparing and inspiring you to run your first ultra race.
Are you ready to feel the highest highs and the lowest lows? Are you ready to do what you once thought was impossible? Are you ready for your trail to 100? Thank you for joining us here on Trail to 100, the podcast made to help you finish your first 100-mile race. My name is Jacob Bateman, and joined along with me is my beautiful and lovely wife, Melody.
Hey, guys.
And in my wife's arm is our son, Travis, as he looks up at the camera.
You can see him if you're on YouTube.
Yes, you can. So today we had a really spectacular guest join us. His name is Jeff Browning. Now, if you don't know who Jeff is, he's one of the best in the world at not only running 100-mile races, but winning 100-mile races. He has won over 29 100-mile races, and he continues to win those races in his mid-50s. And which is very impressive. He actually talks about how he nearly retired when he was in his 40s because he felt so beat up. And then he was found a new way of eating, a new nutrition, you'd say, a new diet. It's called a OFM, optimized fat metabolism / primal diet / low carb diet. He mixes a bunch of principles together and he's created his own sort of nutrient way of eating that has helped fuel him into winning 100 mile races to this day. So Jeff is going to share with us how he eats, why he made the transition, what the transition has done for him, and basically just the basics of what goes into him and his longevity and how he's able to keep doing all these great distances and not only doing them, but performing extremely well at them. So we really appreciate Jeff coming on the podcast today and sharing his knowledge because he's got a wealth of it.
Oh, yeah.
And so we did want to let you know we had a little audio hiccup with this interview. I know we've been at the game a while and we still haven't figured audio out.
It happens.
We're just a couple of average Joes trying to put together a podcast here. So forgive us, but you could still.
Jeff sounds great. Yeah. Our audio just is a little bit off. You can still understand what we're saying, but just a heads up.
But luckily, Jeff does most of the talking in this podcast. Yeah. So anyways, let's get to it. Let's hear how Jeff Browning wins 100-mile races in his 50s. All right, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us here on Trail to 100. We are so excited to talk to you about how you got started with the 100-mile distance and as well as dig into your nutrition style. So appreciate you coming on the pod today.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So first off, Jeff, I mean, what drew you to the 100-mile distance in the first place?
You know, it was a long time ago, so I don't know if my memory serves me well, but 24 years ago or 20, I guess I should say 25 years ago, this is my 24th season this year, 2024. Mm-hmm. In 2000, I befriended someone when I moved to Bend, Oregon, and he had just run his first 50K. He worked for the North Face. And at the time, the North Face was the title sponsor for Western States 100. And so I heard about Western States 100. I was a mountain biker and climber. And I did a little bit of running 3 or 4 days a week with my dog, 20 to 40 minutes. But I mainly considered myself a cyclist and a climber and backpacker. And I was interested in, first, I had never run a marathon at that point. But I had worked at a running store that was also a bike shop in Columbia, Missouri. I went to University of Missouri in college in the early 90s and met my wife there. And we ended up, I worked at that shop while I was in college, this specific shop that sold bikes. And we were the specialty running store in Columbia, Missouri. And so all the hardcore runners came to our shop, and the owner had run Boston 25 times. And so that made an impression on me as an athlete, but I still considered myself a cyclist. But I dabbled in 5Ks and 10Ks just for fun through the shop, because the shop sponsored some. And I just kind of jumped in them. You know, I'd run kind of hard for 2 weeks, and then I'd jump in a 10K or something. But I never really got serious about running until I moved to Bend. And this friend had kind of introduced me. And then I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to run a 50K, you know, like, I need to go run a marathon first. So I ran a half marathon and a marathon in 2000. Piggybacked that training into a 50K in February of 2001, my first 50K. But the whole time, my goal was to run Western States 100. I heard about that first. I was super interested in running 100 miles, but I'd never even run a half marathon at that point. So I just kind of jumped in and kind of fast forward, and I didn't really get into the road scene at all. I just immediately got into trail running, lived in a location where I could train on trails all the time. So I mixed my bike in with running and started ramping up the long run, kind of traditional marathon training, but doing the long runs on trails, and did my first 50K in the idea that, oh, I'm going to get into this 100 miler. Well, then I find out that you have to get a qualifier, and you have to qualify, and then you have to get in a lottery. And so it ended up making me wait 18 months or almost 2 years from when I first heard about it to getting in and running and, you know, standing on the start line. So that was kind of my introduction to Western States. And in the process, I ran several 50Ks, 50 miler, 100K training for Western States over about a year span. And that got me some experience before I stepped up to the line. And I'm glad I had to wait, because it does take some trial and error and testing to figure out what works. And, you know, if I even look back now, I didn't know what the heck I was doing at all, but I made it to the finish line. I ran sub 24 at Western States, my first try, and made a lot of stupid mistakes and ate way too much and didn't drink enough. But got to the finish line and got a buckle, and that kind of got me hooked. By the time I crossed that finish line, originally I kind of set out for it to be a bucket list item. But in the process, I kind of fell in love with the trail running culture and trail running scene, especially ultra marathon and mountain scene. And I kind of, by the time I finished Western States, I was kind of hooked on the sport, and I'd quit riding my bike as much, and I was running a lot more, and my social scene was shifting from cycling and climbing to more runners and trail runners and ultra runners. And then I just never looked back and got sponsored in 2003. And then have been competing ever since.
So, long story short, running is better than mountain biking, climbing, any of the other sports.
Well, they all have their place. But I would say, this is a really good way to think about why it attracted me. Climbing and like going and peak bagging, and I know I hiked some 14ers when I lived in Colorado and stuff like that. I think, and then the fact of, one of the things I liked about mountain biking is you could cover so much distance and see a lot. But then once you're fit enough and you learn to go light and fast in the mountains in ultra running, you can go as long as you could on a bike pretty much, and about almost the same speed in mountainous terrain. Plus, you're not, you know, one of the things you run into as a mountain biker is you're limited on trails. There's some trails that aren't open to mountain bikers, and we're on foot, you're open to everything. You can go everywhere. And doesn't necessarily, you know, you can scramble, it can be super technical, it can be loose and rocky. And a mountain bike, you would have to hike a bike through those kind of sections, and then you're like, it sucks. Whereas being on foot, it's like a combination of all those sports, climbing, backpacking, cycling, all mountain biking, all of it. It's like a mix of all those sports going light and fast in the mountain. I just liked how pure it was and how simple it was, and that's kind of what attracted me to the sport.
Totally. Well, that's what I was going to say is, before you got into running, it sounds like you just had the perfect foundation for running. And I have to agree with you. I feel like, because I used to mountain bike a little bit too, I feel like running is just so like primal and natural, and you don't have to worry about maintaining your bike, and you just put on your shoes and go. So that's awesome.
So you said you made a lot of stupid mistakes on your first 100. I'm curious, what were some of those mistakes?
Well, if I look back at then, I ate way too much an hour. I was trying to just down a ton of calories per hour, And we kind of know now from research that you really can't really absorb much more than 300 calories an hour. And it's probably less than that. All of a sudden that changes like the way we coach it, the way we recommend to athletes, the way we come up with an hourly system of caloric intake for races and long runs, two to 300 calories an hour, you know, somewhere probably 240 to 260 is kind of the sweet spot for most people. And then we find that that works really well and people have consistent energy and you don't need really complex foods while running. And I think a lot of people make mistakes of eating too many solid foods or too many complex foods, meaning a lot of protein and fat, or really uber processed foods that have protein and fat in them, you know, like say a quesadilla, for example, and that's going to be like garbage gut. You know, it can't break down in your gut. It's just sitting there. So you can absorb that kind of complex foods. You can have a little bit of complex food every 3 to 5 hours, but really simple carbs during races and long runs are kind of the best strategy for limiting GI stress because they break down really fast.
So that's what led us into one of the main reasons we wanted to talk to you in the first place, Jeff. So you talked about your nutrition mistakes there on your first 100. At what point did you realize as you started running more and more of these, were you thinking like, whoa, like I got to change something, or how I'm eating or how I'm doing this or what I'm being told isn't working for me? When did you think like, maybe I need to transition to a different strategy here?
Well, I mean, I was always interested in nutrition. You know, I was almost a nutrition major in college and then shifted to graphic design and art and went for the creative stuff. But I maintained an interest in nutrition through that whole time. Most of it early influences came from like bodybuilding literature and stuff like that. Because that was really like the geeky literature that was out there at the time. But then, you know, in the 90s, it was vegetarianism. Like that was the way. And so my wife and I were vegetarians in our 20s for about 7 years. And I just didn't thrive on that. I lost muscle mass. I had lifted weights since I was 14 years old. And in my 20s, I was losing muscle mass on a vegetarian diet. I just wasn't getting enough protein in hindsight. And so, or at least no, not enough bioavailable protein. And so I, at about, let's say 2004, we shifted to a organic whole foods diet. So Nourishing Traditions, if anybody's familiar with the book by Sally Fallon and the Weston A. Price Foundation, like WestonAPrice.org, that information, that's where we shifted in 2004, went back to eating clean meats, you know, grass-fed, grass-finished beef and free-range eggs and stuff like that, and raw milk. And we kind of got rid of our processed food, but we still were doing grains and some processed food, but not in the house necessarily. But if I ate out, I was still going to the bakery to get a chocolate chip cookie. And, you know, I was a traditional high carb athlete. I was just eating mostly organic, but I was still eating rice and beans and all that kind of stuff and bread and pasta. And I did that for about 12 or 13 years. So the first 15 years in the sport, I was a high carb athlete, vegetarian the first few years, but tons of injuries and muscle mass issues, and quit doing that in 2004. And interestingly enough, and started strength training again. And the combination of switching back to eating meat and lifting weights, I won my first 100 in 2005. So that was my first win, was awesome. In 100 miler, Bighorn 100. And from there, I just kind of continued that trajectory for about 12 or 13 years into my 40s. And then when I was mid 40s, I started having a few health issues after some travel to South America and racing and drinking some questionable water during kind of bad weather season. And I came back in 2015 and was fighting some kind of GI stuff. And I don't know what it was in hindsight necessarily. We think it was a candida overgrowth, you know, like kind of a yeast thing in my gut. But I had a ton of flare-ups and some rashes and some weird like GI stuff going on all through the season of 2015. I started talking about retiring from actively competing and kind of fading away. And then I came across I kept having these flare-ups. These flare-ups would happen and last about 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks. And in the middle of one of these, I went into kind of like, this was November of 2015. I went into like a really, really deep research in 1 week on just low carb approaches and how to starve yeast. You know, yeast feeds on sugar. Mm. So I was trying to figure out, how do I starve this yeast? Cause I have, obviously I have something going on. And I worked with a naturopath and trying to diagnose what was going on. And we'd done some different things and kind of had narrowed it down that we were pretty sure, 90 some percent sure, it was a candida issue. So I started treating it as such. And I decided that I knew enough about nutrition at the time that I thought I could manage it with diet. So I kind of got into a bunch of forums on high fat, low carb, paleo, kind of grain free, sugar free approaches, and just eating more natural and I more ancestral and what a hunter gatherer would eat. And so I really got into that. And after about a week of research, sat away and was like, told my wife, I'm like, I think I need to go keto or kind of paleo. And she's like, well, I got 2 cookbooks. And she had been wanting to try it. And she's always been a little hypoglycemic. You know, she was a Division I gymnast. And, you know, back in the day, everybody just ate a bunch of carbs. And she always felt weird on like too much bread, too much pasta. And we didn't figure it out until the 2000s when she was in her 30s that it was an issue with her blood sugar, probably, that it was messing with her blood sugar. You know, she was was having some kind of, not diabetes, but more like blood sugar, kind of hypoglycemic type symptoms when she had more processed, simple carbs that were high glycemic index, you know, like potatoes, rice, pasta, bread, stuff like that. So we started kind of limiting that quite a bit when we figured that out. And we probably didn't figure that out till 2008 or 2009. And then she just was careful not to just eat too much, but I wasn't willing to give up that stuff. You know, I was an endurance athlete. I had to have my carbs. And so I kept doing that. But then when I had this health issue, I realized that, well, I need to do this. And she was already ready to roll. So we started that day cutting out carbs. And I started talking to Zach Bitter. I started talking to Peter Defty at Vespa Power. They both mentored me in the early days of just trying to figure out, like, how do I race on this? You know, how do I, cause initially I did a 4-week keto reset. I was in the middle of training for HURT 100 in Hawaii. And this was December of 2015. So I was 7 weeks out from HURT 100. And when I started doing that, I was like, what do I have? You know, like on my long runs, you know, I had all the same questions everyone else has. It's like, well, if I'm going to cut out, you know, grains and sugar in my everyday diet and seed oils, how do I do that in my racing? And what I figured out was you only have to do it for 4 weeks to initially reset and go strict keto to kind of get that fat adaptation process going and then bring back strategic carbohydrates. So what Peter Defty at Vespa has coined OFM, optimized fat metabolism. And that OFM protocol is to bring back strategic carbs after 4 weeks. So I started doing that, you know, and started bringing back fruit and potatoes strategically around effort and volume. So that way I was topping off glycogen on the bigger days and harder days where I was lifting weights and maybe doing speed work or a hill workout or a long run. And then on the easy days, I just let my carbs kind of naturally get lower and I'd eat more protein and fat. And so I did that initially, had a great HURT 100 and was able to go on less calories per hour. My recovery was off the hook. Afterwards, it was like night and day. I had 2200s as a high carb athlete under my belt at that time. And that was my first 100 finish on a high fat, low carb approach. And I really, the recovery was like crazy because I was in my mid 40s and I was already thinking about retiring and I was just getting beat up. And I thought all the swelling and the soreness after hundreds was because you ran 100 miles, but come to find out it was mainly the high carb approach. So when I got the carbs in a more manageable level from natural carbs, you know, more from a hunter gatherer style diet or what we call an ancestral approach, then all of a sudden I didn't have those symptoms. And so those symptoms were linked to my diet. And we've seen that across the board with coaching OFM athletes. You know, we have quite a stable of OFM athletes over the years that we've coached. And we get the same feedback every single time, especially if they have a long standing relationship with ultras and have some experience in 100 milers. They're like, wow, my recovery is so much faster now, you know? And we're talking guys and girls that are in their 40s and 50s and 60s. So they have a good years of doing the sport in a high carb approach like I did. And just to see that difference is kind of crazy. And you feel younger. It's easier to stay to maintain weight, race weight, or a healthy weight, and not be overweight. And that's one of the things you do run into in your 40s and 50s. You tend to gain weight faster. So just because your metabolism slows down a little bit, your protein synthesis slows down a little bit. So your protein intake needs to go up after 40. And over the years, this whole approach is kind of evolved for me in the past, say, 8 years. I'm more probably a higher protein approach now. I'm more like 1.1 to 1.3 grams of protein per pound of body weight per day intake. And then I eat a decent amount of fruit, not a lot of veggies, a few salads here and there, and some sauteed or baked vegetables occasionally. But I do a ton of fruit, 2 or 3, 4 servings of fruit a day, plus some potatoes occasionally in strategic, bigger training blocks. And then I do a decent amount of protein, a lot of red meat, a lot of organ meat, you know, eggs, raw milk, raw dairy, stuff like that, cultured dairy like yogurt. And that's kind of more the approach I've been on for a while now. But the early days, I probably was a little less protein, higher fat, and I've evolved into higher protein, letting some of those protein macros replace the fat macros, and some of the carb macros replace the fat macros as well from fruit. So, and raw honey and stuff like that, and raw dairy. So that's kind of the, you know, if you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint over what way I've tweaked the way I eat, and I would argue probably that's the way Mike McKnight's done it too. You know, I coach him and we share a lot of notes, and we both have tested strict carnivore. We've gone strict keto. I went keto, what I call chronic keto, for a long time in the early days, and I think probably too long. And I would also add that we approach this differently with depending on gender. So like women are going to be more a higher carb approach. I tend to like a different approach for women. I don't like to go strict keto except for like a quick reset of maybe 3 or 4 weeks and then start doing something called fuel separation method, which is a little higher carb approach, but thinking about separating fats and carbohydrates as your macros. They're both, if you consider them both energy macros, you would separate them depending on the protein source. So protein's a constant. So if it's a lean protein like chicken breast or chicken tenders or tuna, which is a lean fish, that naturally is low fat meat or no low fat protein source, then that would be coupled with carbohydrate. And so the carbohydrate would be the energy macro. And then if they were doing like a fattier protein like steak or salmon is an oily fish, or chick, you know, skin on the bone, thighs on chicken or stuff like that, or any kind of red meat, that's naturally going to be higher fat content. So we would kind of instruct them to have a low carb side with that, because fat's the natural. You could have extra fat with your low carb. Like if you're going to have a salad, you could add olives and you could have avocado and you could have, you know, avocado based dressing and that kind of stuff. But you'd have good, you know, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated or monounsaturated fats. We're still avoiding seed oils, which is kind of the ancestral approach. But really animal-based is what I'd consider it now with strategic fruit. So it's what Paul Saladino, if you're familiar with his work, Dr. Paul Saladino, it's paulsaladinomd.com, I think. He kind of has evolved over the years. He managed some metabolic issues with a strict carnivore diet for a couple of years. And then he started bringing back raw honey and fruit, and more from like a, what we really consider a hunter gatherer ancestral approach. And what he calls it animal based, but so your foundation is animal products and raw dairy and eggs and fish and fowl and herbivore. But the rest would, the little top of the triangle would be fruit, raw honey, stuff like that. So I really like his approach, especially as far as like from a nutrient density perspective and bioavailability. Both fruit and animal proteins are extremely bioavailable, 90%+ bioavailable, whereas a lot of veggies or vegetable source proteins are going to be really low bioavailability, probably under 50%. So you got to eat double to get the same amount of nutrients as you would just eating a 6-ounce steak. So I know that's kind of a long-winded, but that kind of gives you kind of a snapshot of where I've been and where I've gone.
Yeah. So this is where my mind's going. First of all, this is awesome. It sounds like kind of magical. Like, why doesn't everybody eat like this?
Because there's so many carbs that are so accessible and they're cheap and they're and right. they mess with your mind because they taste good and they're sweet and they're slightly addictive. So there's an addiction
there.
Whether it's psychological or physical, there is an addiction to that stuff because it is kicking off certain endorphins that make you want to eat more, more food.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. It is super addictive and it's everywhere you go and it's cheap. And so this is what I'm thinking right now is this sounds awesome. I'm feeling a little bit overwhelmed and a little bit discouraged because I'm like, it sounds like you have years and years and years of research and studying and years of trying different things and figuring out what works for you. I guess my question is like, if someone wanted to start, I don't know, I guess what I'm saying is I'm like, man, if I want to eat like this or figure out what works for me, I feel like it's going to take me, you know, 30 years. What would you say to that?
Well, I say you have to start somewhere. And I think the easiest way that at least the way we approach it with athletes we coach that you start with prioritizing protein in every meal. Don't snack. You eat a meal, let it burn for 3 to 5 hours. You don't constantly eat. Chronic snacking is really bad for your GI tract. It's really bad for digestion. It's bad for your like toxic load, meaning your GI tract never gets a chance to clean out and like get a rest. So I can go into a side trail on this, but there's something called migrating motor complex that was kind of the research was pioneered out of Colorado State. But it's basically when you get that growly stomach, that actually isn't hunger pangs. That's actually like contractions in your GI tract from when food has moved out of digestion after 2 to 3 hours. And then it starts to do this contraction thing, and it's a cleansing process to clean the GI tract up from waste left over from digestion. But when people chronically snack, anytime food goes into digestion, just a peanut, you know, one thing, it's all hands on deck back to digestion. So if you constantly are a chronic snacker, you're never going to have that cleansing mechanism kick on. So I like to think like when my stomach growls, I like to think, oh yeah, migrating motor complex is working. So I know I'm getting a little bit of a cleanse. That's one of the reasons that occasionally intermittent fasting is actually a good thing, because you're actually taking all this food out of digestion, letting the body clean up. So I don't think you need to get chronic with it. And I think you have to be careful as an endurance athlete how much you would use it, right? You have to use it very sparingly and very strategically on easy days, rest days, you know, stuff like that. And I think you can get some benefit out of it. But you know, if you're in a big training volume, you probably shouldn't be doing too much intermittent fasting. You should be getting calories. So, but I do think starting small, like prioritize protein would be step one. Make sure you get that 1.1 to 1.3 grams of protein per pound of body weight per day. That's going to fill you up. You're not going to have a lot of room for other macros when you go to hit that number. Right. For example, I'm 142 pounds, 5'8", 142. I shoot for 150 to 180 grams of protein a day. If you prioritize that kind of protein, and I do it in 3 to 4 meals, depending on the day and the activity level. So I'm trying to eat a decent amount. Right. So, but that will fill you up, and then you're going to get some fat out of that for in most meals. If you're having eggs or red meat or anything like that, you're going to get fat as well. Now, if it's lean meat, you're going to be needing to get some carbs in there, and you need to get some, you know, fruit or something like that, or potatoes. But generally avoiding 80% of the time, if you can avoid added sugar to stuff, grains, anything that's grain-based, flour-based, right? Or seed oils, meaning polyunsaturated fats, because they're rancid and our bodies aren't very good at utilizing those fats. They're extremely oxidized by the time we consume them because they're the most unstable molecular chain of the fats. So that would be stuff like canola oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, soybean oil, vegetable oil, stuff like that. We would want to avoid those kind of oils. Now you got to read labels. That's the other thing. I think that if you're going to make a shift, you got to start reading labels and be educated on what's in your food. Like the less ingredients, the better. And you know, for me, when I see a seed oil, it's like, no, put it back on the shelf. I'm not buying that. You know, if I see canola oil or sunflower oil or safflower oil or something like that, good avocado oil, olive oil or monounsaturated fats really good, but they still do oxidize under light, like air and light. So you and heat and high heat. So you don't really want to bake with them, but you can saute with them. But saturated fat like butter, ghee, coconut oil, lard, tallow, those are all saturated fats. So use saturated fats to bake with, to cook with, to like, you know, especially if it's going to be high heat or if you're going to fry something, it needs to be in those because those molecular chains, saturated fats are the most stable. So they're most stable under heat, light, and air. So anyway, that kind of covers oils, right? Added sugar, grains are the other and flour based. And the reason we try to avoid those is because of the anti-nutrient value. And anti-nutrient value would be stuff like phytic acid, oxalates, and lectins are kind of the three big three. There's others, but those are the big three. And so what those are those are going to be like, for example, phytic acid would be present in like wheat and beans and stuff like that. And that phytic acid blocks like iron and zinc absorption. And so what I mean by anti-nutrients is that it has some kind of a toxic load on the system, or it blocks some kind of protein, you know, some kind of absorption of another vitamin or mineral. And then the last thing would be things like lectins that are in soy, like soybean oil. You want to avoid like the plague, any kind of soy products, soy, don't drink soy milk. They're high in lectins. Lectins are a molecular mimicker. They act like a protein you can break down, but they act and they unlock the blood barrier, and they get into the bloodstream, but they actually can't be broken down. And so they kind of wreak havoc. So they kind of cause inflammation. They're already rancid anyway, by the time you're consuming, you know, those oils. So avoiding those kind of oils are a really good thing to do. If you're just trying to clean up your diet, we kind of recommend athletes go look at either Paul Saladino's work, like we were talking about earlier, or Mark Sisson's work at Primal Blueprint, which is the marksdailyapple.com. I think he's in the middle of completely revamping his site again. He has a very, very robust nutritional blog and informational site at marksdailyapple.com. So I think that's in the middle of being redone last time I checked. But we definitely push athletes to read that book and follow his process. He has a really good cookbook, excuse me, that came out in 2017 called Primal Kitchen Cookbook.
So, go ahead.
So with all this, I think those were great starting points. I feel not as overwhelmed.
Yeah. I'm like, I feel like that's a good place to start.
That definitely makes it feel like
meat, fruit, then vegetables in that order. You know, animal products first, then fruit and raw honey and raw dairy and stuff like that. And then vegetables and other stuff. And I would say shoot for 80-20 or 90-10 rule. That means if you're having 24 meals a week, right, then you would be somewhere in the 2 to 4 meals a week. You don't sweat it. If you're going to go out to eat with friends or you're going to someone's house for dinner, don't worry about it. Or just try to choose wisely while you're there. After a while, you know what to, you know what is like really bad and what are bad offenders. And you're educated. That's why we try to educate our athletes too. We try to go through all the stuff we're talking about. I you know, I'm probably putting this through like through a fire hose right now, but think about it. Think about it over the course of say a 6-month relationship. We talk every 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And you have a bunch of written information, you know, behind the scenes that you can tap into as well to absorb it, you know? So that's what we're really recommending to athletes when we're trying to coach them into this lifestyle, because it is a lifestyle change and you have to look at it as a lifestyle change. It's like, I'm educating myself on those things are poison. And so I want to limit my poison, right? And so that's kind of how I personally look at it, is that it is a little toxic to my system and my body doesn't really assimilate it well. It doesn't want it. It doesn't thrive on it. So I need to limit it. Doesn't mean I can't have it. I don't need to get dogmatic about it, right? I don't have to be so hardcore that I never touch it. It just means limit your exposure, right? So it doesn't mean it's necessarily, you know, something you have to always avoid. It just means limit it. And 90% of the time you're eating really, really, really well and really, really nutrient dense and really, really bioavailable.
So you basically teach the exact opposite of what I've heard most nutritionists and dietitians teach.
Yep. Well, if you understand where nutrition has gone, and this is one of the things I'm thankful that I did not become a nutrition major, because I would have been taught that dogma. Now you have to go back and unlearn everything, because a lot of the dogmatic stuff that's in mainstream nutrition is coming from some of these early studies from the 50s, 60s, and 70s and 80s that were bought by industry, the grain industry, yeah, the big ag lobby, the sugar lobby. These were manipulated. The diet heart hypothesis of saturated fat and cholesterol cause heart disease. That's been debunked by over 70 more recent studies, and they can't even reproduce some of the studies that are still getting quoted today in mainstream dogma. So, you know,
That's crazy. The
seven country study by Ansel Keys still gets quoted, and it's been debunked. He had that original study was 23 countries. He had to throw out 15 countries to make a seven country study because they didn't fit the hypothesis that, you know, high saturated fat and cholesterol in the diet cause heart disease. He had 15 countries that did said otherwise. Right. And I always say, just simplify. Don't think about like all the stuff that's been bought. Think about us as our ancestral background is hunter-gatherer, hunter-herder, hunter-herder-farmer. And we've always been hunter-gatherer or hunter-herder first, before farming. Farming was always for times of lean. It was a famine food. You stored grain and beans and stuff like that for times of lean, right? When you couldn't go out and hunt it, when you couldn't go out and kill something out of your herd, right? That's what we thrive on. And if we look at how our GI tract is built, it's built more like a carrion bird, like a vulture or something like that, or a dog or a coyote, than it is any other animal. So we are built to eat kind of fermented meat, and we have canines, eyes on the front of our head. Like, we are a predator. We're part of the circle. We're not at the top of the food chain. We're part of the circle. Anybody who's a trail runner out there knows when you go run in the backcountry and you run into a mountain lion, you're quickly part of the food chain. You're part of the circle. Yeah. Doesn't mean you're at the top of it.
That's for sure.
So,
go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, with this, what you're saying, I mean, it makes sense in everyday life, but I'm trying to wrap my head around race day, because when you pull up to those aid stations, it's anything but hunter-gatherer a lot of times.
This is something to really that gets confused in this approach when it comes to endurance performance and training and racing and long runs. Simple carbs are on those days only. So we use them on efforts over 2 hours. Anything over 2 hours, you're bringing in carbs, you're bringing in simple carbs. The simpler, the better, right? Gels, powdered drinks, you know, you got to have electrolytes per liter. Start there. And that's something we could dig into a little bit as race and long run nutrition. And we recommend that's when everything's on and what works. So what works for you? You know, for me, that personally, that's Tailwind, you know, an IV drip of Tailwind regularly, 125 calories between every aid station. I'm drinking in one of my bottles. The other bottle has water in it, but I also add extra electrolytes to my Tailwind. So I have a decent amount of sodium in there as well. And I'm sipping on that constantly and then washing it down with the water in the other hand, right? To rinse and swish and swallow. That way I don't get taste fatigue in a longer race. But I'm always have this IV drip of base calories coming in there, super simple, easy on the gut. And I'm only maybe getting a dose of two to three calories every sip. So that's number one step. The other step would be just having a lightweight or a strategy of every 30 to 60 minutes, having some kind of solid or semi-solid coming in, whether that's gel, chew, block, gummy bears. You know, I get organic gummy bears at natural grocers and put them in a Ziploc. I do salted plantain chips or banana chips for just, you know, a couple chips. I do like avocado oil based potato chips as well. So I'll sometimes mix those in longer races. And then I stick to like fruit or potatoes at the aid stations, real food, just a little bit, you know, a third of a banana or a couple orange wedges, where I might just squeeze the juice into my mouth and leave the pulp on the rind. You don't need fiber, during the race. Mm. So avoiding high fiber foods during the race as well, or else you're just going to be in the bushes all the time. So just really simplifying and having an hourly food strategy, caloric strategy that hits that 240 to 260 calories an hour target for most people. Some people can go less if they're more fat adapted and doing kind of what Mike and I are doing. You can go on less. I go on about 200 calories an hour, but I race on like up to 250 an hour if I'm pushing hard. You know, I might be popping extra gels and stuff like that because you're burning sugar and you are still tapping into fat on a regular basis. All ultra runners are. If you're a long distance runner and you're training a lot and you're kind of that conversational pace 80% of your time, then you're going to be an okay fat burner, right? And women tend to be better fat burners than men naturally because of childbirth and taking care of a baby and nursing and all those things. You know, you go into ketosis during nursing. That's why you lose your weight so fast.
Interesting.
So knowing that the women go, that's why women can't go chronic keto very long. They, you know, I like to call it chronic keto because keto is not a long-term diet. It's more of a tool in your toolbox to be used a day here, a meal here, a week here as a reset after the holidays when you pigged out. Like here and there as a tool to help kick back on that fat metabolism at a higher rate, you know, and restrict some carbs strategically for a while and then get back into normal training where you're bringing in, you know, 100 to 200 grams of carbs a day from fruit, potatoes, instead of that, you know, traditional keto of 50 grams or less.
That makes sense. So, okay, I know this doesn't have anything to do with running. This is just a selfish question, I guess. Why do some women, so I know that some women will lose a lot of weight when they're nursing, but some women can't, like they hang on to their weight while they're nursing. They don't lose it until after. Do you know why that is?
I'm not sure. I don't know if I could. That's definitely not in my wheelhouse as a coach, but yeah. I can speculate, right? But it could be like what the macros they are consuming while breastfeeding. If they're eating a bunch of junk and really high carbs, then that could be part of it, right? That's why I always say prioritize protein, because the studies, you know, basically definitely back up that the higher the protein intake, the faster the recovery and the better the body composition. So, you know, we see that across the board in all athletes, women and men. If we could get them to prioritize their protein first, their protein intake, and really like get a big percentage of their macros, you know, from that, not we're saying, you know, let's say 30 to 40% of their macros from protein, then all of a sudden they're going to lean up. They're not, if they are overweight, they're going to lose weight. And if they're more lean, they're just going to get more muscular. So, you know, you're going to get definitely a muscle building effect. And once we hit 40s and 50s, this is when it really becomes important, because we're not really building muscle anymore. We're just trying to maintain muscle mass as we age, because most people lose it. I mean, just go look at I've been in the sport for almost 25 years, and I've seen people, you know, who were in the sport in their 30s and now, right, are in their almost 60, and they've lost all their muscle they used to have. You know, because maybe they don't have a strength training program and they don't eat enough protein. You get those two together and you lose a ton of muscle mass after 50.
It sounds like protein and strength training is the key to life.
Yeah, I do. I honestly think you're so right. There's a lot of wisdom in that, because I would even argue that people that are looking just to be healthy, that if you could prioritize protein and lift weights, you don't even have to go run. Just go lift weights, spend time in the weight room, lifting heavy things and being strong and having a good movement patterns. You know, work on mobility as you age too, because mobility tends to suffer after 45 or 50. And that's when we really get injured, because that's how we break a hip. You know, when you're 70 years old, you break a hip because you trip and stumble and you go to fall and you can't catch yourself anymore. You can't reach your leg way out in front of you and do a deep lunge, or you can't put a... You know, you can't twist at the trunk anymore and put your hand down and windmill out of it or whatever, right? And that's where older athletes really, especially in trail running, and everyone can relate to this who's a trail runner, when you go from running a 12-minute pace and kick a rock on a downhill to going 5-minute pace trying not to kiss dirt. And when that happens, you're really like the people who have worked on their mobility probably or might skin their hand and put their hand down and like be able to pull out of it. But the person who hasn't is going to eat the dirt for sure. 9 out of 10 times. And then you're going to get even further injuries.
That, as you're talking, I'm like, wow, we have a lot of work to do. Especially
you guys are young. You have plenty of time.
Well, Jacob's turning 30 this year.
Be an old man soon. So do you ever, now that you've made this switch, when you run 100, do you ever deal with GI issues still? Or for the most part, they're gone on race day?
Most of the part, they're gone. I've gotten it down to where, you know, I've done the precision hydration sweat concentration test that shows like your genetic number for sodium concentration per liter of sweat. So I know how much to replenish on a per liter basis drink rate for me specifically. I've done scale tests where you do, if anybody's ever looked up the how to do a home sweat test, that's your sweat loss per hour. So that's volume of sweat. Okay, not concentration of sodium, that's different. But these are two different puzzle pieces to hydration. The other is how much you lose on an hourly basis in different temperatures. So let's say, for example, you go, the way you do this test is basically you have a digital scale, you'd strip down, weigh with no clothes on, record that weight, record the temperature outside, get dressed up, go for an hour run, don't drink, don't pee, come back, strip down, towel sweat off, weigh again, record the loss. That loss is, you convert it to ounces. So if it was a pound, that would be 16 ounces. You would drink 16 ounces in those temperatures. Now, what you see when we have athletes chart these is there's a big variability in individuals. So like one person at 55 degrees is going to lose, say 750 milliliters, and another person is going to lose double that at 55 degrees. They'll lose a liter and a half. So their drink rate has to be drastically different at 55 degrees outside those two different people. Like they're very individual. So for example, I lose a half a liter at 40 degrees and I lose a liter at 80 degrees. So I know my drink rate needs to be higher in the heat and lower at night at 100 miler when I'm running through the night and it's 40 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. I only need to drink a half a liter an hour just to replenish my sweat rate.
Makes sense.
Then how do you, sorry, go ahead. I just got excited. So then how do you know how many electrolytes you need to be taking? Or I guess, what is it, like grams of electrolytes?
So sodium would be the number one number. And then potassium on top of that, you need about we kind of coach a 6-to-1 or 5-to-1 ratio of sodium to potassium in your electrolyte drink. And that's we base it on people's individual numbers that they get through the precision hydration test, which is a medical grade test. This is not to be confused with all the wearables that are out there trying to tell you how many electrolytes to drink. This is a medical grade test that's been patented into a briefcase test by Precision Hydration and then trained a bunch of affiliates to administer the test. And used to be a $3,000 medical test. Now it's a $200 or $300 home test that they can come to your house or you can go to their office and get that test. I've had the test, but we do base it on the average that Precision Hydration has tested over 10,000 people, retested people. That number doesn't really change for the individual. So you can't train it. It's genetic. And so what we recommend is about a 90 to 100% of whatever that number comes out to be. Now the average over 10,000 athletes is 900 milligrams per liter. That's sodium. 900 milligrams of sodium per liter drink rate. In that, when you're talking about electrolytes, we mainly need sodium. We need another 6-to-1 ratio or 5-to-1 ratio of potassium. And then you need trace amount of magnesium. You don't need too much magnesium. Our bodies are pretty good at holding on to magnesium during a race or during sweating. It just really dumps potassium or sodium mainly in a little bit of potassium. So we want to replenish that in our drink. And so we recommend people do the average as a starting point, 800 or 900 milligrams per liter drink rate. And you figure that out. You got to look, you basically do a nutritional report card when you go to your long runs. Like keep track of all your packages and everything you take and all the pills you take and salt pills and anything else, you know, whether it's Salt Stick or Succeed or whatever, Duralytes, and keep a running list. And then you know, say you run 5 hours, subtract the first hour because you don't really need to do a lot the first hour. You can sip to thirst and a little bit of calories, but not much. You're pretty topped off coming into a workout or even a race. So the first hour doesn't count. So if you run 5 hours, you count 4 hours. That makes sense. So if you were going to do a report card, you'd keep a column of calories total, sodium total, and then drink rate. So however many liters you drank or whatever. And then you're going to divide the drink by four hours, right? Remember, subtract the first hour. If it's a 5 hour run, 4 hours, then you're going to subtract, divide it by four, and you're going to divide your calories by four, but you're going to take your sodium and divide it by how many liters you drank to get your sodium per liter. So those are the numbers. Okay. And if you people out there are going to run 100 miles, you need to figure that out, and you need a system. Yeah. An hourly system and a per liter sodium per liter system. That system you stick to, you make minor adjustments on the hour and by the conditions, depending on heat and sweat rate and temperatures throughout the day and throughout the night, your drink rate and your ebbing and flowing, all that stuff, and keeping that stuff in a system that you can micro adjust.
So basically, if you're going to be an ultra runner, you need to be really good at math.
It's very basic math, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have these things called smartphones, and they have calculators on them, so you don't even have to do math. You just have to know which number to divide by which number.
Exactly. This is just real broad question here. I think I've heard this before. I wanted to know if you knew if this is true or not. Too much sodium, can that give you the runs?
Can that cause cramps?
In one dose, it can cause you major. It's a cleanse. So if you go out right now and I use Redmond Relight, right? The Utah company, really, really the cleanest salt on the planet. So Redmond Real Salt or Redmond, and they have an electrolyte product called Redmond Relight. And I use Relight regularly. You know, that's what I have mixed into this glass right now. And so if you get a decent amount of sodium in one dose, so like, let's say you drink a pint of water and you put 2000 milligrams of sodium in there, in about an hour or less, you'll probably have to use the restroom about 3 or 4 times in about the next 2 hours. It's going to cleanse you out. Okay. So you really want to, like, you don't ever want to overwhelm it at one time. Like anything, the body does really good on the IV drip. So not overwhelming the gut. And then usually about up to 1,000 milligrams in one setting, your body's pretty good at dealing with. But anything much more than that, it starts to kind of freak out a little bit. So we definitely recommend the IV drip of those calories, or I mean of the electrolytes when doing that.
What are your thoughts on, and I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on LMNT or Element?
It's very similar to Relight.
Okay.
Yep. I personally like the transparency of the practices at Redmond, and it's an inland sea salt reserve underground. And so that's that ancient salt bed that they're tapping into. And it's extremely clean of microplastics and other pollutants. Whereas most sea salt is going to have pretty high microplastic count in it. Most Himalayan pink salt is going to have a high tin count, so metals in it, because of where it's harvested. And then the salt that LMNT, I used to take LMNT some. I quit doing it personally just because my wife and I dug into to their practices and where they're sourcing their salt. And LMNT, I would say, does a good job of sourcing their sodium, but it's not coming from an extremely clean source like Redmond has. And Redmond's is better. And so that's why I use that product.
All right. Okay.
Well, looks like we're trying some Redmond.
Yeah. I feel like my foundation of nutrition and everything I know and believe has just totally been shattered. I'm like, dang.
Well, Jeff, we won't take too much more of your time. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing all this. Like you said, you came at us with a fire hose and how you normally coach people through this through a month, you know, 6 month long process or such.
I feel like this is a great kind of basis, though, if you're interested in this.
It was. I feel like I have a much stronger foundation in it. real quickly, though, I just wanted to ask you a question, non-nutrition related. Maybe it is nutrition related, but you've been at this game a long time and have a lot of experience in the in running ultras. Like, what has running ultras brought into your life that's like kept you in the game or like help you learn about yourself? You know, like what has it done to you in your life?
Well, I mean, a lot. I now it switched my career from graphic design in my 40s to coaching. It's taken me all over the world. I've seen some really beautiful backcountry places on different continents. So travel has been cool, and that experience. I've also you learn a lot about yourself. You learn to overcome adversity and realize that, okay, I just need to figure this out and move on. And sometimes you just got to push the pain down and make friends with the pain cave and deal with it. So like, it makes you tougher. I also just really appreciate the training personally. I've always lived in a place where I have trails pretty close to my front door. And so it's very accessible terrain for trail running and dirt running. So I run 80, 90% of my volume in on dirt. And so I'm in the woods every day at lunch, and I love that time.
That's a good life.
Yeah, that's my time. That's my alone time. That's my one-on-one time with my own brain. Sometimes it's a podcast to learn more, you know, or something like that. But it's always to tap into that natural factor that a lot of us don't even tap into anymore. And I think that's one of the things that ultra running really brings to the game is the wild factor. Just being in the wild and really tapping into your kind of ancestral self. You know, we were hunter gatherers. We used to live in it every day, be in it every day. And now we're in these boxes and don't even have natural light half the time. And, you know, we're looking at like a screen all day and, you know, instead of hanging out on a rock in the sun and, you know, lounging at noon. So, you know, we just don't do that anymore. And so I really appreciate that part of the sport.
For sure. It's no wonder it's no wonder our society is so sad.
Yeah, yes. They need to tap into some woods, man, and find their phone, some single track.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you, Jeff, for joining us on the podcast today. We were super excited to have you on, and this has been really an enlightening conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will benefit from it. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you win hundreds in your 60s too. Yeah.
So a big thank you goes out to the legend, Jeff Browning, for joining us.
I still have so many questions.
Right? I felt when he said, like, I'm giving this to you guys in a fire hose. Like, I literally felt like I was, I don't know
being
why,
but in the face by a fire hose.
Yeah, no, well, but I just like almost went to like the comics, the cartoons where you got a fireman with a fire hose. And then I guess firemen have dogs, right? Or there's Dalmatians, always dogs around, yeah. And there's like a dog standing there, and he's got his mouth open, and I'm like the dog and the fireman. And the fireman,
that's a
strange
visual.
The fireman's just spouting that water right at me, just and like my mouth is catching like a ton
some
of the water,
but all of it.
But like my whole face is engulfed, and I'm missing so much of it still.
You know, I guess that's a good visual.
Yeah. So that's how I felt after talking.
This is definitely a podcast I feel like you need to re-listen to, or maybe even sit down and take notes.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I think what really needs to happen is this is a great pod. If you're looking at this style of eating, thinks it can help you in your life and your running, I think this is like a good, okay, this is the overall, this is what
I do.
This is
a great way to get started.
But then
now if you're interested, now you got to
buy a book on it,
do
research, or hire him or a coach. I know McKnight does this as well, you know, so.
I was just going to say, we're going to put Jeff Browning's contact information if you do want him as your coach in the show notes.
Yeah, and he has multiple coaches that work under him that all teach the same thing. So big thank you to him for doing that. So Mel, what's your takeaway after talking to, or your thought, final thoughts on talking to Jeff Browning?
Yeah, I guess my final thoughts are this way of eating, this lifestyle works for Jeff Browning, works very, very well for him. And it may or may not work very well for you. I think the bottom line is, here is some knowledge. Here's an option that you can dive into and learn more about if you want. But just remember that everyone is different and you need to figure out what works best for you.
Yeah. I've listened to Jeff Browning on other podcasts, and he's flat out said, like, he's like, I got nothing against vegans. I got nothing against someone who eats this style. He's like, this is just what's worked for me.
And it works for a handful of people. And like I said, you may or may not be one of those people that this works for, but you know, if you're interested, then look into it some more.
See, I am very interested in
this
style.
I think you would do really well.
Yeah, I think
with
this
and kind
of
style.
And I've bought a couple books. I'm starting to read up. I'm trying to make some more transitions. Like Jeff said, I'm working on making protein a priority first. Just making those simple moves, trying to implement this more style, because I have had so many gut issues in every single ultra, and I'm just fed up with it. And I'm like, if this really can take your gut issues, I know Jeff said he mainly does it for like the recovery.
Yeah.
But I know Mike McKnight does it for the actual in race gut issues, because Mike had terrible gut issues until he made his transition to this style of
eating. And I feel like if you have gut issues, this isn't the only option to fix your gut issues.
Yeah, there's more.
But even Jeff Browning said that this is a good way of eating for people with a sensitive gut.
Yeah.
Which you definitely have.
Yeah.
Plus you have done, I feel like, diets very similar to this that you've done really well on.
Yeah. That's Travis snorting, if you guys heard that.
Anyways. Yeah, you'll probably hear him in the background here.
our 4-month-old kid. Anyways, but honestly, here was my main takeaway though. Jeff is like a scientist with his body and with his running.
Oh, he is just a wealth of knowledge.
And he talks about how like he
wealth
gets
of
together.
Knowledge, well of knowledge.
He takes notes on everything, and he's like, yeah, I exchange notes with Zach Bitter. I exchange notes with Mike McKnight, you know, with other people who are eating similar to him. I just, his scientific approach, like he views ultra running like the scientific approach, basically. And he implements that into his nutrition and into his running. And that is why here he is at 50 years old, still performing the way he's performing and winning all these races still. Anyway, so a big thank you to Jeff for taking time out of his day and giving us that taste of his style of nutrition and how it's helped him in his ultra running journey. Remember, if you guys have any questions of your own, you can contact us through our website at trailto100.com or through Instagram at trailto100. Also, if you could leave a rating and review for us, we would greatly appreciate it. It helps us to continue to grow the podcast so that we can continue to get great guests on the show like we had today. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you want to run 100 miles, make it happen.